Georgia's the new hotbed for musical talent, and the music industry knows it. Record executives are turning their eyes to the Peach State to discover the next big thing. On GPB's Peach Jam podcast, you'll hear those rising Georgia artists before anyone else. Listen and discover the sound of what's next on the Peach Jam podcast from Georgia Public Broadcasting.
Coming up on this episode... Hurt people hurt people, right? So are we learning the way he was hurt? I guess you're not going to tell me, but that's what I'm curious about.
Well, we find it funny the way 20-year-olds talk.
Me too. That means we're old now.
Some of the scenes in the book are very disturbing.
Yeah. Okay, so rom-com.
What are we talking about?
This podcast from Georgia Public Broadcasting highlights books with Georgia connections. Hosted by your two favorite public radio book nerds who also happen to be your hosts of All Things Considered on GPB Radio. I'm Peter Biello.
And I'm Orlando Montoya. Thanks for joining us as we introduce you to authors, their writings, and the insights behind their stories, mixed with our own ideas and thoughts about just what gives these works the narrative edge.
All right, Orlando, what are we talking about with the book selection today?
Well, today we're going to talk about the difference between the art and the artist. And perhaps I'll start with a question. Is there an artist, a writer, or really anyone that you really, really like his or her work, but this person really troubles you as a person?
No, there are a few, but the first one that comes to mind, and almost ashamed to talk about this because of just the stereotype of the white guy writer type. But David Foster Wallace, he's a writer whose work I really enjoyed. I've never finished Infinite Jest, I should say, but his shorter work I really enjoy. But he's problematic because he was a stalker. He gave his ex-girlfriend a really hard time. And he had a lot of mental issues and died by suicide in 2008. But if he had lived to present day, he likely would have been canceled by now for everything that he had done.
Well, we know about Ernest Hemingway and his problems and his troubles. We know about, you know, people like Bill Cosby. I remember I used to go to a karaoke where there was several rules, but among them was you couldn't sing R. Kelly. So if you wanted to sing I Believe I Could Fly, you can't do that one.
Was Michael Jackson okay?
No, Michael Jackson was fine.
Wow, selective, okay.
So anyways, this book is really about the difference between the art and the artist, and it's also a romantic comedy.
Okay, romantic comedy, and that's not really where I thought this was going, but cool.
Well, it's a rom-com, and it's about this serious topic, and I promise you, it works. The book also could be considered a workplace satire. It could be considered a literary mystery. So if any of those things sort of appeal to you, this is the book for you. It's called Hot Desk by Laura Dickerman. She's a writer from Atlanta.
Okay. Does that term need a little explaining? I mean, is it hot desk like a hot sheet motel, but a hot desk?
Hot desk. Never heard of hot desk. Never okay. Heard of hot desk? Hot desk is a term that refers to a workplace condition where you share a desk with other people. Like maybe you have it in the morning, someone has it on the afternoon, maybe you have it on Monday, Wednesday, Friday, someone else has it on Thursday, Friday, different days. Or maybe it's just like an open concept workplace where you share offices. So that's what we mean by hot desk.
And does this take place in an era before remote work became such a thing?
This place takes place in 2020, 21. It's sort of pandemic era.
Okay.
So
you have to suspend disbelief that this is not an option for them and go for it.
I think that was the timeline. I think because they were doing a lot of Zooms.
Oh, okay.
Meetings.
So if they were doing Zooms, remote work could have been possible, but for the sake of this story, they need to share this desk.
Yeah, so for the sake of the story, our two main characters, Rebecca and Ben, are sharing a hot desk in a New York City office that's shared by rival publishing companies. So they each work for two different publishing companies, but they share the same desk. They're both really junior employees. They're in their 20s. At this publishing company, they're competing for a chance to land their companies a big publishing deal. Mm-hmm. And that's the rights to publish the unpublished work of a recently deceased author, a literary giant of the 20th century, sort of a fictionalized amalgamation of, you know, Ernest Hemingway or some of the people we've been talking about. It makes no sense to tell you you know, the fictional author's name, because he goes in the book simply by The Lion. Mm. And here's Laura Dickerman to tell us about The Lion.
The character of The Lion, I call him, is kind of a sort of a mix of different writers at the time, I would guess. But I also wanted to transcend an actual person. I wanted to create someone that would symbolize or stand for this kind of man that I'm interested in. So someone with the charisma of Byron and the popularity of Hemingway and the talent of Philip Roth, and just make him this very charismatic, genius writer, but also someone who acts with impunity and treats particularly, I would say, women in a way that's problematic. So I was very interested in that, in the guise of a rom-com.
So does she ever explain what got the guy canceled?
Well, he wasn't exactly canceled. It was just sort of like, as time progresses, you know, things change, and at some point people, but especially women, just kind of get like an ick factor to him. So he kind of has like bad marketing now. sort of like these artists that we mentioned earlier. And it's just like the way he talked about women, the way women were portrayed in his books, sort of hyper-masculine persona. And so this marketing problem is going to be a problem for our two main characters. Again, these two junior publishing reps who want to get his unpublished works published.
Okay, so tell us why it's a problem.
So The Lion just died, and we find out that he doesn't just have like a few notes that are unpublished. He has an entire novel that's unpublished. It's like sitting in a secret place in his house, like on, you know, handwritten paper, and it's a very bad novel. Hmm. I mean, it's bad from a writing perspective, and it's bad from a problematic women's perspective. And so whichever one of our romantic leads, Ben or Rebecca, lands the deal is going to be moving up in the company. But to land the deal, one of them will have to convince the Lion's widow that he or she is the best one to carry on the Lion's legacy.
Wow. And what is the widow's interest? What does she primarily care about? Is it just money?
You know, she's interested in money somewhat, but she's not as interested in money as the Lion's son. So there's a character in the book that's the Lion's son. He's really caring about money. He just wants the dollars. But the widow, she's more concerned about the legacy of her late husband, and she controls the estate. So the problem for Ben and Rebecca becomes, you know, exactly what we're talking about. You know, how are we going to present him in his death? What's the right thing to do? And so let's take it from a number of perspectives. First, Ben's perspective.
The most interesting evolution, I would say, in the book is the young character of Ben Heath, who's one of the romantic leads. And he's a young man who idolizes the Lion. He has grown up reading his books. He is gone into publishing because of the books. And so I feel as though he's a character who has a bit of a, I would say, comeuppance, but it's also evolution. So he learns to reconcile the bad behavior of the man with the genius of the books. And I think he doesn't want to, I don't love this expression, but throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Hmm. So I'm curious how he reconciles those two things. How does he evolve as well?
Well, sort of Ben learns through the course of the book, as the reader does, more about the Lion, more about this unpublished novel. And we also learn more about the Lion through the personal stories of Rebecca, his love interest. And they eventually do meet at some point.
So wait, what do they learn about the Lion that would change the way they feel about the negative aspects of his work?
I am going to not answer that one.
Is that a plot point that would ruin things?
Yeah, I think that is a thing that you have to discover in that.
Well, that's really important, because that's what occurred to me. Like, is there something about this guy that would make me feel like, okay, he did some awful things, but I could see what led him to do those things? I mean, hurt people hurt people, right? So are we learning the way he was hurt? I guess you're not going to tell me, but that's what I'm curious about.
Well, we learn more of the good and we learn more of the bad. I'll say that. And you can imagine what bad is as it relates to women and treating them badly.
Well, yeah. I mean, I've read a thing or two about the publishing industry, and especially when, you know, the white men, you know, the boomer generation and older have had the control of things, and it was not a good scene for women. So you can imagine all the things that happened.
Some of the scenes in the book are very disturbing.
Yeah. Okay. So rom-com.
What are we talking about, a rom-com? Yes. Well, they don't meet Rebecca and Ben until more than halfway through the book. So and that's what I like about this book in some way. You know, it's got multiple different aspect through it. But, you know, spoiler here, Ben and Rebecca don't meet until later in the book, and they will have a happy ending. But they get together first when all of the main characters come together for sort of like a business meeting. You know, it's
the most romantic of settings, a business meeting.
Well, if it's love at first sight, that's what it was.
Footsie under the table, perhaps.
Yeah, it was love at first sight. I mean, we've all been there. You see someone, and even though they're competitors, they've been knocking on each other. I mean, that's the wrong word. They've been
no, it might be the right word.
They've been spatting at each other through office email and through, you know, subtle, you know, placements of office furniture and things like that. Mm. So anyways, they finally meet, and we see their relationship go from cold to hot, hot and spicy.
Hot and spicy. Okay, that's great. Well, so that's Ben.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit more about Rebecca. Like, what's her background? How does she evolve?
So she has an evolution as well, and it's just as complicated as Ben's. Rebecca's evolution is informed by her mother.
When you see Rebecca, who's this young woman in publishing and very confident and, you know, says what she thinks and has very strong opinions about these men, the discovery of this unpublished manuscript of The Lions reveals a very surprising link to Rebecca's mother, Jane, who worked 40 years earlier at The Lions literary magazine, what I call the East River Review. And when you go back, when the novel goes back in time, 40 years, you pick up with Jane, who's also a young woman in publishing, and her experience is very different from her daughter's 40 years later. And so I was interested in comparing the two, the mirroring of the two timelines and of the experience of women in publishing, both then and now.
Okay, so there's a 40-year difference in some of the scenes here. How does that back and forth work time-wise? Is there two separate tracks and 40 years difference?
It's not throughout the book, and that's what I like about it. Some books are really annoying with this sort of back and forth timeline situation. Mm-hmm. But in this book, and when I say annoying, I mean it's just like constant going back and forth. I mean, in this book, it's really focused in sort of one section of the book, I think, and it's only used when needed. And it's needed to, you know, sort of tell the tale of what happened to Rebecca's mother 40 years ago. And it sort of also gets to the question of why are Ben and Rebecca here? Because as I mentioned, you know, these are junior level employees. Why are junior level employees being sent to see the widow of a literary giant to negotiate a publishing deal? And so that's why we go back in time, to pick up those relationships, to learn more about the lion, to learn more about the widow, to learn more about Rebecca's mother. And again, I don't want to give away too much, but it's part of what kept me reading. Mm-hmm. And that is, as Laura says in the clip just there, sort of the experiences of women in the workplace 40 years ago are much different than they are today. So,
yeah. Speaking of the workplace part, right? We've talked about the romantic comedy part of this, but you also mentioned it was a workplace satire in
workplace
some ways.
Workplace satire, yeah.
So tell me more about that.
So the book is set in an office, obviously, and it's set in this publishing world. And, you know, these two junior level employees are making kind of witty, spot-on observations about their bosses, and they're talking about their Zoom calls and their workplace apps. You know, we use Teams, we use Zoom, we use any number of things. And, you know, that provides some humor in the book, you know, the way offices work. Who hasn't had a funny Zoom call moment? Are you the guy in the Zoom call who points out when someone's camera is on and they don't think it's on?
I know you are.
I do.
Because you've done it to me.
I know that. Your camera is on. Your camera is on. So this book interacts with communication technology in a way that's funny and very realistic. So, and actually that's part of the appeal of the book too.
That it's realistic and it sort of mimics life. So that the relationship between these two unfolds in a way you feel like is authentic.
Yeah. I mean, I have, you know, I'm having conversations with people on the phone. And so I asked the author about that aspect too.
One of my pet peeves in books is if the dialogue doesn't sound realistic to me. So I am very interested in how people really speak. And if you're going to write about 20-somethings, you have to write about texting. You have to write about DMs. You have to write about the way that they communicate, particularly, obviously, with people who haven't seen each other and only communicate through writing. And I, because they are people who care passionately about books, about authors, about writing, they're both in publishing, it takes on an even more important weight in the book, how they write, how they speak in writing to each other.
And so when the characters in this book are communicating via text message or app, you actually see that in the book with those little blocks.
Oh, wow.
You know, so it's realistic and like that. I like that.
It sounds like a nightmare for whoever's laying out the book, but awesome for the reader, you know, to have that kind of realistic depiction of what's going on. All right. So before I ask you about the big question, I want to go back to The Lion for a bit because I'm curious about the fate of that book. I mean, a lot of big name writers who die, that book's going to see the light of day someday simply because, good or not, it's part of the culture now, or that person is part of the culture. We need it to be able to study it.
Well, it's sort of like a what would you do moment, right? So take your favorite author, and then you discover that your favorite author has written this terrible book that's just awful. Would you want it out there?
Well, I kind of would, because I guess because I'm used to seeing that kind of thing right now. Like all, even when I was a teenager, like new Hemingway books were coming out. I remember when I was a teenager when True at First Light came out, and it was not like praised as the hidden work of genius that had been sitting in his drawer. But it was a Hemingway. Like, we want to see what he wrote because he's a major American writer. Now, he was also problematic in his way. I don't know, because I didn't read it, whether or not that particular book was problematic in the way that Hemingway was problematic, but still seems like it would be an important part of the culture.
So
I guess that's why it's important to know what The Lion did, I guess.
This is the, sort of the big question of the book, you know, how will The Lion be presented? And, you know, what happens in the end, you know, sort of takes into account everything that we've learned in the book, the relationship between the lion and Rebecca's mother and the widow and the son, even Ben. And so I think the person that ends up, you know, sort of scoring the deal with the lion's widow is a surprise. But so are some of the things that we learn about the widow and Rebecca's mother. But in the end, I think everybody has a happy ending. There is romance.
Okay.
I will tell you that. And I think it ends up very fair. It ends up very fair for the lion because we have to know about these things that happen. But it's also fair to those people that the lion has hurt. I will say that as well. So I think that in a way acknowledges his greatness, but also his issues. And, you know, in the end, you know, I'm not, again, it's not quite it's not a spoiler at all to say that, you know, his work is going to get out there. It's just a sort of what work and how.
So
I think it's a very satisfying ending.
Okay. So overall, what gives Hot Desk the narrative edge?
So I picked up the book because it was sort of like a book about books, you know?
Yeah.
I'm like a rom-com set in a publishing house. I kind of want to hear that. But I kept reading because it's sort of several books at once. You've got this mystery of why is Rebecca in this position? What happened to her mother back then? And why is Ben in this position? And what will become of them? As a couple, which of them will get the deal? And will the Lion's legacy be tarnished or not? In the end, I don't think it is. I think it is just explained a little bit more. And so, you know, I think it's funny too. I really do. All these little snipping that they do at each other, because it's sort of a hot and cold relationship. And then the language, you know, these people are talking like 20-year-olds do. I find it funny the way 20-year-olds talk.
That me too. That means we're old now. Yes. Yeah, that's what that means.
So
6'7".
I don't know what that means.
That's a thing that kids say now. Okay. I don't know why.
Does that mean the
I spent some time with my nieces recently and it's 6'7" everything.
Does that mean the podcast's over? We're gonna 86 this podcast.
No, it means the transcript's gonna be picked up in all sorts of Google searches now, I guess.
Okay. Yeah. Well, anyways, it's a great book. I highly recommend it. It's you could think it starts out slow, but I liked it through and through. The romance part doesn't happen until the end, but I liked it through and through.
Well, I haven't read it, but I'm already inspired to passive aggressively move your desk furniture around. So that's great.
We don't share a desk.
I know. I'm
going to
go out of my way.
We don't
to move your
desk
stuff around. No. All right. The book is Hot Desk by Laura Dickerman. Orlando, thank you very much for telling me all about it.
Thank you.
Georgia is the new hotbed for musical talent, and the music industry knows it. Record executives are turning their eyes to the Peach State to discover the next big thing. On GPB's Peach Jam podcast, you'll hear those rising Georgia artists before anyone else. Listen and discover the sound of what's next on the Peach Jam podcast from Georgia Public Broadcasting.